Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Midlothian Council Audit Committee. I'll start, as usual, with introductions around the room. My name is Mike Ramsey, Independent Chair.
Grace Vickers, Chief Executive.
Alan Turpey, Legal Services Manager.
Chris Lawson, Risk Manager.
Yeah, Alistair Short, Joint Director of Health and Social Care.
Gary Fairley, Head of Finance and Integrated Service Support.
Stephen Reid, External Auditor.
Sarah Croft, External Auditor.
Councillor Kenneth Beard.
Councillor Peter Smail, Provost.
Councillor Andrew Hardy.
Councillor Derek Mulligan.
Councillor Jim Ured.
Jill Stacey, Chief Internal Auditor.
Mike Broadway, Clerk to the Audit Committee.
Thank you very much. Can I assume apologies from Councillor Parry? Thank you. And Mr. De Vink just joining, so that's good. Is everyone happy with the order of business as set out in the agenda? There being no objections, do we have any declarations of interest? Again, none. So, first item on the agenda, the minutes of previous meetings. We have three previous meeting minutes to consider under 4.1, 4.2, 4.3. Does anyone have any questions or comments on the minutes, please? My only comment, I think, is on page 10 of them. I think we've got a 2017 typographical error. Should be 2018. Page 10, item 4. Subject to that typo. Sorry, Mr. De Vink.
Now, on the previous page 6 of 292, that's also part of those minutes, presumably, I noticed that there was this referral to the 4 weeks, and that was quite a long time ago. It would be nice to hear what the latest update on that is.
At the moment, the roads investigation is ongoing, and the difficulty with asking specific questions about the progress of the investigation at this stage is that it might prejudice future actions. So, if possible, except insofar as it's necessary for the specific business of today's meeting, could I ask that specific questions about the Rose investigation be avoided until the investigation is concluded? Could I have a proposal for the minutes to be accepted?
Before we do that, sir, on page 19, I wrote down that I recall there would be an undertaking from the section 95 officer that there would be an explanation as far as the confusion that occurred over the creditors and debtors. It would be done offline, but offline is something that ought to also be done in the minutes, I feel.
Mr. Fairley?
Certainly I can assure Audit Committee a response went back. In fact, it was from the questions from Provost, and that response went back and copied into a number of members. I look to you as Chair in terms of if you would like that that added to an amendum to today's minute, that would be of assistance.
Perhaps if you could circulate the details to the remaining members of the audit committee who weren't included in the original circulation.
If there were any, I thought I had included everyone.
If there were any, and then
I'll review that and circulate it.
That would probably close the matter. So are we content the minutes are a satisfactory record? A proposal from Councillor Milligan.
Yep.
Thank you. Sorry, the proposal was from Councillor Muirhead. I always get... as a result of our own review of our activities, item 4.4 is an action log in order to track activity requested by the audit committee in order that we can follow up and ensure that actions that we request are delivered. The first action log is here at 4.4, containing three actions, two of which are concluded within this agenda, and the third item will become an ongoing item. Are we happy that the action log actions 1 and 2 are to be closed? I'd like to ask Ms. Stacey to just comment on item 1 to confirm how the Treasury management issues are going to be dealt with in future.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the Audit Committee may recall when we presented our internal audit review of the Treasury management arrangements as part of our 2017-18 work. There were three recommendations that internal audit made around that, and also a comment from the committee about another particular action. So in terms of the all of those actions, a non-competitive action form has been completed to support the decision taken over the Council's use of Treasury Management Advisors. That is now complete. The letter of engagement agreeing the term of appointment and fee is in place and was updated to refer to Midlothian Council. Again, that action is now complete. Another recommendation, internal audit recommendation, that the three main Treasury management reports should be submitted to this committee to enable them to adequately scrutinise Treasury management arrangements within the Council prior to these reports being presented for recommendation to Council. The timing of the committees in terms of the schedule of meetings. A proposal was submitted to Council in August, and it's intended, you'll see today on today's agenda, the annual report for 2017-18 is on today's agenda, albeit it's already been to Council, but in future that will come to this committee in advance of its presentation to Council. We expect that the mid-term Treasury Management Report for 2018-19 will be presented to this committee at the next meeting on the 11th of December. And of particular importance and scrutiny, the Treasury Management Strategy for 2019-20 for the proposed January 2019 meeting of this audit committee. And that will the scheduling of those meetings would that enable that internal audit recommendation to be completed in full. The final internal audit recommendation relating to the risks associated with Treasury management and that they should be recorded on the Council's risk management system, Pintana Performance System, to allow the routine reporting, monitoring of risks associated with Treasury activities. Work is underway in relation to this, but it remains incomplete. But we'll, as part of our standard follow-up process, we will follow up that recommendation in due course. The final element related to clarification of the Treasury Management Code. And just for, again, the benefit of members, the Treasury Management in the Public Services, there's a code of practice that was issued in December 2017. Guidance notes for local authorities has been updated in association with the changes to the code of practice. We've got clarification that the code of practice and the guidance notes are effective for the financial years commencing on or after the 1st of April 2018 and in association with the Prudential Code for Capital Finance and Local Authorities 2017. So at the time of the internal audit review and the assurances that we were providing to this audit committee, this new Treasury Management guidance was not in effect. So just clarification as the context in relation to those new codes of practice. Hope that's helpful for members of the Audit Committee.
Thank you very much. Any questions, any members? No. In which case, we move on to the first item. First paper on the agenda, 5.1, the Local Government Workers' Pay and Grading Report. Mr. Fairley, will you be reporting that?
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Members will recollect that a draft or an earlier version of this report was tabled quite late at the last Audit Committee, so we've taken the opportunity to review the report and bring back a more updated report. And really, the purpose is to provide committee with details of the benefits arising from the changes to terms and conditions which were implemented back in October 2016. Section 2 of the report sets out the previous reports that had gone through Council, which were, there were numerous reports, and they date all the way back to the financial strategy in February 2014, which is at the first point where a review was proposed in terms of the structure, and that was the first review really from the implementation of the Single Status Agreement in 2009. Section 3 of the report goes on to set out what the case was for change, and it highlights a number of benefits that were at the heart of the review around tackling in-work poverty, making Midlothian an employer of choice, the need to ensure that we had a pay and grading structure that could secure or sustain increases in the living wage and maintain differentials. Adopting terms and conditions and an HR policy framework that would support and facilitate service change, and ensuring that services could be adapted to meet customer needs, and adopting terms and conditions and a policy framework which would bring improvements in both productivity and attendance. The result of the review altered terms and conditions, a reduction to 4 recognised public holidays, 2 Christmas, 2 New Year, from the previous arrangements, with 5 days moving into part of annual leave entitlement. And just as a bit of background there, historically, I think a public holiday day incurred something like £80,000 in premium rate costs to cover services on those days. So the flexibility that came with that brought benefits. Contracted Saturday and Sunday working previously had a premium. That premium was removed. We retained a premium for night working, increased the threshold for overtime premium payments to 40 hours, and reduced the overtime premium that was paid above 40 hours. There was a change in the annual leave entitlement and an increase in the standby by payment for staff that work overnight, etc., and they're on standby. So that was a sort of brief summary of the changes. In terms of progress since implementation, the pay and grading structure delivered a substantial increase in the lowest earners, grades 1 to 3, between 7.4 and 14.4% in the first year. We addressed or made improvements in terms of the gender pay gap. for both basic salary and salary package, and that's set out in section 3.22 of the report. Also had implemented a new code of conduct and a range of what I would describe as progressive people policies. We also introduced a range of non-financial benefits that staff could access as part of that. On page 27 of the agenda onwards, the report then goes on to give some of the harder stats around the impact. Sickness absence is covered, spend on agency, and as part of the changes, we put in a robust agency policy to make sure that agency staff were last resort and only used in specific circumstances. Additional hours, and I think we recognise there's more work to be done. There's a relatively static number of additional hours worked, so these are people working more than the contracted hours, up to the 40 hours at plain time. And we've got more work to do to look at where we can contractualise those hours to give people security over their income and earnings. Premium rates, as you would expect, with a change in the premium rate cost, premium rates spend has come down, but there is still a level of overtime. And I think as a management team, we want to see what the opportunities are to actually employ more staff rather than rely on a lesser number of staff who are then required to work overtime. We've also seen a change in our casework levels, and that's around disciplinary and harassment cases. Those are at a very low level. In total, the disciplinary cases for 17-18 around about 8, and against the context of over 4,000 employees, it's a relatively low number. But nevertheless, each one of those is an issue in itself. So that's a very broad run through in terms of the report of the sort of harder numbers and the things that can be evidence. There is still ongoing work through the Investing in Our Workforce Board, chaired by the Chief Executive, where we will look at areas where we want to drive further improvement and drive further benefit from the changes that were made. The pay and grading structure and the terms and conditions I think we have now support a more flexible approach to delivering services 7 days a week from the traditional Monday to Friday basis of service provision. And certainly in terms of the financial impact set out in Section 4, although there was more money went into the basic grading paying grading structure, there was a significant return and an offset from changes in terms and conditions which helped support that contribution. And indeed, we expected a significant part of the cost to be incurred anyway as the living wage kicked in and saw pay rises increasing. I know from across Scotland that there are a number of councils who have still actually got to integrate the living wage within the main pay and grading structure. They still pay the uplift to the living wage is effectively a supplement to earnings to their pay and grading rather than it being integrated. So Section 6 of the report then just summarises really the key issues in terms of what I've said. And in Section 7, we're really asking Audit Committee to consider the commentary in the report, note the monitoring ongoing through the Investing in Our Workforce Project Board, and the ongoing development of the use of pay metrics by service management to inform change and also to drive change. So happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Councillor Smile.
Yes, the overall principle here is that by increasing the basic rates, we were able to reduce very heavy overtime payments, both by the quantum, but also, as you pointed out, by the incidence of overtime payments. When we last discussed this, the payoff was that there had been a projection, as I recall, about $500,000 that this would cost us. When I look at the table on page 26, you extrapolated well into the future, where it looks like it's costing almost $2.7 million a year to do this. I'm not against the principle of what we do, but I just think we want to track whether that is what you expected in terms of the cost to the council. Second thing is, I'm just slightly surprised that you say at the bottom of page 28, the overall employee headcount in Midlothian Council has increased by 4.6%. Electors might find it strange that at the same time that we're having to let a lot of staff go under early retirement provisions, we're actually hiring more in. And I think that goes to the piece about the relative cost of agency staff.
If we can perhaps answer those questions in reverse order. I suppose the increase in the overall headcount recognises Midlothian's the fastest growing council, so that headcount will include the new teachers that we've recruited, the new staff in terms of early years. So over that period we've increased to 600 hours and we'll then move on to the 1140, and also the additional demands that are coming through the social care sector in terms of home care and care at home in terms of additional staffing. Expectation is that overall the staffing complement will continue to grow in key areas, but the financial context means that there are other areas where we need to reduce our staffing complement and reduce it quite quickly, and that's what you're seeing coming through in terms of those numbers. So it's getting behind the headline number, which may show an increase, to the areas of decline and areas where we need to look to retrain and redeploy staff versus to support the growth. And indeed, at Council in February, Council agreed a £200,000 redeployment fund to help that transition through there. In terms of the numbers, in terms of the cost, at the point of implementation back in October, the costs that are set out, sorry, just find the section in the report, those were the costs that overall the paper would rise by 1920 by 2.6 million, but that £2.3 million of it would have been incurred regardless of whether we'd made any changes. So then I suppose the cost of the proposals less the offsets was around about the £300,000 to £400,000 mark. And we have seen continually through the pay settlements at a national level those continue to support the living wage in terms of the baseline pay. And as I said earlier, a number of councils struggling or to come to terms with how that impacts on the differentials at the bottom end of the scale.
Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, Gary, thank you. It's quite a positive report, and it's probably gratifying to see that we're now moving away from people having to rely on overtime to get a decent wage. So I'm quite happy with that. I'm a wee bit disappointed. I thought the gender equality would have actually been a bit more, so I'm a wee bit disappointed in that, but it'll be whatever it'll be. It's heartening to see again in the report that the sickness absence is continuing with the downtrend, but I wonder if you can let us know. It seems that in August that there seemed to be a spike which has pushed it back up. I think it talks about it being for the highest since 2016, and it's just to sort of see how we got to the bottom of what that is. But the big area, I think, we've talked about where we've reshaped to take a lot of overtime out of the budgets. What work's been done with the corporate management team to look to see if we're going to reshape the services we deliver to drive some savings out of that? And I'll give you some examples that I would think of in layman's terms. If you look at waste collection services, their vehicles run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, most of them. You're spending big money on, like, say, gully cleaners, etc. And the work 7-8 hours a day, Monday to Friday. Have we been looking to see whether we reshape that kind of work so that we can make or drive some savings out of the cost of the investment in this kind of machinery? I would expect maintenance costs would go up slightly, but overall I would have thought it would drive some savings out of the capital area. And it was just to sort of see if we've reshaped or we're looking to reshape the workforce to deliver along the lines, but we've been able to do that now without having to pay enhanced rates.
Again, if I can maybe approach those questions in reverse order. In terms of using the revised terms and conditions to reshape services, then my expectation is that that's what all service managers are looking at, what the opportunities that create. I know that we have within Waste Services the bottom-up review, and I would anticipate that options around the best way to deploy the workforce and the expensive equipment and machinery will be part of that. That review in terms of the information the group are given and also the outcome from it. So yes, in short, expectation that those sorts of areas will be absolutely front and centre in terms of the responding to the service challenge and transforming services. In terms of absence, there's work is ongoing to really get to the bottom of the spike in August and to see if there's anything structural in there that we can learn from that and look to avoid such spikes in the future. As I say, that work's ongoing. I haven't got anything in terms of information with me to give you a more fuller answer at this point, but happy to take that away and report back in terms of any underlying issues there that we need to be cited on. In terms of the gender pay, I think just to come back on that, Councillor Milligan, the remaining issue is really around the profile of the workforce. So we have a lot of predominantly grades 1 and 2 female workers, and then 4, 5, 6, some of the middle grades, it switches over to sometimes more men in those grades, and it's that gives rise to the overall gender pay gap that we currently have.
Yeah, I'm just wanting to make sure that when the bottom-up reviews do commence, that we'll have the information, but there has been work done, so we're not starting right at the start here, so as we know what savings are possible by shifting over, so we're not having to start the bottom-up reviews and then sit and wait on that information. I'm just hoping that kind of information will be available.
I'm certainly happy to feed back to colleagues that aren't here today.
Yes, and further on in the report, I noticed there's a number of comments from Ernst & Young about the need to accelerate the pace of change. And whilst this report highlights a number of good things that are happening, I think it would be nice to see a little bit more on the productivity side, which I think was at the core of the question. We're asked to note that the Invest in Our Workforce Board is monitoring implementation of the pay and grading review and the productivities. I wonder if from this committee it might be sensible for us to ask the Performance Review and Scrutiny Committee to take reports as and when they see fit to keep an ongoing monitoring on this. It is an ongoing risk, obviously, still in the risk register. So we'll keep an oversight there, but perhaps the day-to-day monitoring of delivery of productivity improvements following on from this should be something that's reported there. I don't know what members think of that. Do we have any other questions or comments on this paper? In that case, if we take an action then to go onto our action log to request the Performance Review and Scrutiny Committee to monitor activity under this area. Thank you. In that case, the next report is the Annual Treasury Management Report. Mr. Fairley again, I'm afraid.
Thanks, Chair. Presenting today the Treasury Management Report, which was taken to Council and approved by Council back in June. And as Jill has articulated, we've revisited the audit timetable to allow these reports to come to Audit Committee in the first instance. In terms of the actual report itself, which starts on page 37, Section 2 outlines the main points of Treasury activity in the year. Two new long-term loans taken of which amounted to £20 million. One a maturity loan from the PWLB, our main lender, and also one EIP loan sourced from Dutch Vanbrief Bank, and that was a forward dealt loan which helped us take some hedging on interest rate risk. That was done back in February 16 with a loan drawn down in June. Secured two longer-term investments in terms of our cash reserves with two councils, Warrington and Plymouth. Those are set out in terms of the structure of those arrangements. In terms of our external debt, an average rate marginally up, but 3.37%. In terms of the rate to fund or to support the borrowing the Council incurs to support its asset base, and our average return on investment sitting at 0.64%. The pooled rate still is expected, in terms of the loans fund, is still expected to be the lowest in Scotland. But if we were actually operating at Scottish average, then the team identified that we'd incur additional loan charges. So by performing better than the average, the cash saving is something like £3.3 million in last financial year. Members will also note, or sorry, Senate members from Council, in terms of the final outturn report, we reported a change in the apportionment of interest between General Fund and HRA during the year, which brought, I think it was something like a £1.131 million benefit to the final outturn. And that's reflected in the figures within EY's report in terms of the performance for the year. Section 3 set out changes to the Treasury management strategy that we wanted to secure agreement for and did it in June. And Section 4 touches on the further developments, including the revised code that Jill touched on earlier, and also the markets and financial instrument directives that the team are navigating through in terms of the impact that has on our Treasury activity. The recommendations to Council were to note the report and to approve the changes in Section 3, and then appended to the report are the loans fund rate comparison across the 32 councils, the annual Treasury management review itself, the detailed document, and detailed investment benchmarking analysis. So happy to take any questions today from Audit Committee on the report.
Mr. Devine.
Thank you. There's no doubt that the performance of the Treasury Management Group is outstanding. I have great respect for it. But I come back to something that really is probably not my responsibility or the responsibility of the Audit Committee. But I cannot believe that for the exposure that we have got, we make exactly £203,000 of income in excess of what we would do if we had not got such an extensive activity. Now, I don't know how much the cost of running that activity is, but it will be quite significant. It will take up an awful lot of management time. And I now see that we are lending money to two boroughs. One is Warrington and the other one is Plymouth City. Now, how healthy are those two authorities? If they are like Nottingham, it really is a very, very great concern. And I feel... Sorry?
Northampton, sorry.
You're quite right, Northampton. But if it's like Northampton, then it could really get us into very deep water. Now, we have a total turnover, I like the French way of chiffre d'affaires, turnover of our great institution is £397 million. Is £203,000 really worth the risk that we could run that we lose not just 20, not just 30, but possibly even as much as 40 or 50 million, should there be yet another, as is so much forecast, 2008 financial crisis round the corner? Now, the Council has made the decision that they want to do this, but I really would like to caution them and say to them, are they really wise to take such a minuscule reward, because 203,000 is minuscule, for the risks that we are running? Now, I know this makes me very unpopular, but I have to say what I have to say. Thank you.
Mr. Fairley, do you have any comments on the risk assessments on the deposits?
Yeah, I suppose, well, first of all, I think it reinforces the need for the Treasury Management Report to come back to Audit Committee in terms of the strategy in advance of it going to Council, so that Audit Committee's recommendations about the strategy, the investment and borrowing strategy can be articulated to Council. And I think we'll see a report come forward to Audit Committee in January 2019 before the Treasury Management Strategy is agreed by Council alongside the budget. And there's a requirement for the Treasury Management and the Prudential Code to be agreed by Council at the meeting at which it sets its budget. So I think that gives some answers in terms of the future. In terms of the actual Treasury Management itself, the investments that we've made are done within that the framework of the strategy agreed by Council. And I think, as I said before, we would look through the risk associated with those investments in terms of the security over our investment, the liquidity of that investment, and then the yield that we get. So security is very much a key part of the risk assessment that would be carried out. The £200,000 in terms of the alternative is then probably to put those investments into into government, into the Debt Management Office, and secure a significantly lower return on that investment. Although it may be a relatively small sum, you quoted £200,000, I think the difference on these investments between the investment we have and DMO would be significantly more. And it's I suppose about managing that risk. The risk that comes with taking lower investments would be an impact on the revenue account, which in turn means less money to pay for services. And I think that's a decision Council has to make in terms of the parameters it sets with the strategy, whether it wants to take an absolute risk-free, if there ever is such a thing, approach to Treasury Management, and the consequences of that being an impact on the available resources. I appreciate what you say about Northampton, but I'm not aware that there's any question about Northampton Council having defaulted on any of its borrowing or being unable to make payments. It's more a matter of having the resource, being able to balance a budget rather than any risk of default on credit. And there's certainly we'll have done the work in terms of Warrington and Plymouth City Council to make sure that we are comfortable with those investments. I need my colleague Gary Thompson, who has a key role in Treasury activities, here today and can answer any detailed questions. Overall, we're managing an investment book at the moment. I think last night it was something like £79 million, and overall borrowing is something like £230 million. And we've got two or three people on the team that do that work day in, day out, supported by our advisors, Link Asset Services, who are well respected in Scotland and across the UK. So I don't know if that gives you, it probably doesn't give you the level of reassurance you would like, Mr. Devink, but I think the key thing going forward is that Audit Committee can thrash that out before the report and the strategy go to Council, so that concerns can then be flagged with Council and they can make informed decisions.
Mr. Devink.
Yeah, and I very much am in empathy of what you are telling me, but I still am young enough to remember what happened in the Western Isles and the enormous problems that they had encountered at the time, and there were other councils that did the same. We are, whether you like it or not, you use the word, we are incurring a risk by investing in these instruments. And is it our core business, I'm just asking, to do that? But it is up to the Council to make those decisions, and I will abide by that, of course. Well, I've got no other choice. But I would like to caution the Council that they are really, in this very, very uncertain environment, you're talking later on about Brexit, you're talking about a very, very alarming amount of commentary about another big financial crisis. I just would like Midlothian to avoid falling into the greatest manhole ever dug.
Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, I think Councillor Devine's quite right to raise his concerns with us. I mean, I think I've raised these before with you, Gary, and it's been, I think in layman's terms, what we seem to talk about was taking our money and sticking it under the mattress as a savings proposal, as acquired to actually invest in it. I've got to say, for the report and for the investment strategy, we seem to be doing, as we have done for years on years, we seem to be performing a lot better than most other councils, significantly better than Edinburgh Council seems to be performing, which is quite surprising with the strength of investment that they have. But what you did say there, Gary, was is that Peter gave a figure of about £203,000, and you say it would be significantly more than that if we shifted this investment into, I think, government bonds and areas you gave us an idea. What do you mean by significantly more there? Is there a ballpark figure at all you can give?
If you just give me a second, I'll just check what today's DMO rate roughly was and do a quick calculation for you. So I think in terms of the £15 million, you're probably talking in terms of the current rates on those is 1%. So we took we took just the money with Warrington, and that was then placed in the DMO. That deal alone would result in a loss of investment income of around about £75,000 a year. And bearing in mind we've got about £80 million in terms of investments at present. So they're all at different rates, but those are probably two of our highest return investments. So on that one deal alone, the difference between what we've done versus putting the money in DMO is £75,000 a year impact on the revenue account. That's on £10 million.
So if you're just multiplying that by the £80 million, you'd be talking about £750,000 of difference, if that was just merit.
Yeah, probably not as high as that because they're all at different rates, but the logic of that calculation is right.
Councillor Smale.
Obviously, if a single deposit position failed and was insolvent, it would be a very serious matter for us. But I'm not expecting that. What might be more likely is that a depository institution starts to have a worse covenant. So where we put the money that used to give us 2% can, let's say, only raise money by offering 4%. At that point, there might be an impairment required under fair value accounting. I believe historically this has not been the case because our deposits don't run beyond 364 days. But I would just like to ask either the auditors or yourself, are there circumstances in which our deposit positions would become subject to impairment even if the entity was still solvent?
I need to go and review that. I don't have an answer off the top of my head on that. It's not a circumstances that I feel I've come across, but happy to take that away and check what the accounting code says, unless colleagues to my left have got the magical answer.
I was just consulting with my colleague who's got the detail. No, we'll take it away and come back, I think.
Thank you. Can we just note an action for a reply back on that question for our action log? Thank you. I think the key point on the questioning is really if we get it. I mean, the team are to be congratulated for doing an above average and coming out top on the benchmarking. But there's a point at which, as an ex-banker, I would say if the rate's too good to be true, it might be. And it's a balance of where the risks are, and that's, as we've said, something that council needs to consider carefully when it's setting the strategy for next year. But as long as you have no warnings about these particular exposures for the next 6 months until we look at the strategy, that's possibly the end of the deposit question. I just had one question on the report on the question of maturity of lending, points 3.3 and 3.4 in the report on page 43, I think it is. 38, 39. There's 20 million of longer term debt. Our actual maturity profile, although we say there's been no debt rescheduling, and there probably hasn't been any recontracting of existing or negotiation of terms on existing debt, nevertheless, our age profile on the lending has been pushed longer, as far as I see on the reports. Am I reading that correctly?
So, first of all, the part about no debt rescheduling on the last bullet point at the top of page 38, that really refers to the loans that we have, the external facing loans we have with the Public Works Loan Board. The interest rate environment is such that it wouldn't be best value to try and restructure those rates. The premiums on early termination would be prohibitive. Section 3, and going across the page in terms of points 3 and 4 on page 39, really then looks at restructuring of our internal loans fund arrangement. So the loans fund, if you think of it operating as a separate entity, then lending money to services to fund investment, restructuring the internal repayments around those transactions. And that's work that we're currently doing, and we'll conclude that in the current year. And that will be reflected in probably quarter three monitoring to council.
Thank you. Yes, I was confusing myself with the 2 points. Councillor Smale.
Just an administrative point. Some lucky folk here have a pack for this meeting with 292 pages. The rest of us have 288, which means very often when you quote a page number, it's slightly out.
Unfortunately, I have the 292 page report. I know what my other question was on page 38, 39, items 3.3 and 3.4. The report was to come back to the council at a later stage. At what later stage was that going to be? Is there a time horizon on that?
Yeah, my expectation is that will be reflected in the quarter three monitoring, which would go to council on the 12th of February. So that's our backstop date, so that piece of work is concluded in advance of the council setting its 1920 budget.
So will that likely come to, since it's Treasury management, will that be part of the Treasury management in January that you're expecting to see?
Yeah, because we're doing it along the same time, then the Treasury management strategy going forward will reflect that change.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions? No. Which brings us to the internal audit report on social housing programme. Ms. Stacey.
Thank you, Chair. So apologies, but the internal auditor that carried out this piece of work is unavailable for today's meeting. However, for the benefit of the audit committee, this report is in a new format to provide internal audit assurance, and in a new format to respond to comments from management and indeed this committee about the length of our audit committee report. So we've introduced that for our 2018-19 internal audit work. The report itself has been discussed in advance with the chief executive directors and heads of service at a corporate management team strategic leaders group meeting on the 12th of September, where we discussed the findings and the improvement actions. This audit covers the growing council risk around population growth and plans in place to fulfil its statutory obligations. The audit reviewed the adequacy of the capital investment control framework established by management to allow for the successful delivery of the social housing programme. During the audit, we focused on phase two of the longer-term programme. We reviewed the management and control of the following areas. We looked at how project cost timeframes and the quality of build are monitored. We looked at what controls are in place over the management of the contractor, supplies and consultants. And we looked at whether there are adequate controls in place over changes, variations and post-completion sheets. In summary, a number of the key controls were seen to be operating effectively to manage the delivery of the social housing programme, and we found four areas of good practice, which are noted in the report and provides positive assurance to management and indeed the audit committee on the governance. However, it should be noted that the delivery of the social housing programme is off the original target. These are due to factors out with the control of the council, but they are monitored and reported by management on a regular basis. Thus, the openness and transparency in relation to this matter. And there have been a number of issues that underpin that. Within the report, we've raised three medium and four low-rated recommendations that are designed to improve the internal controls, and these are detailed in the findings and the management action plan within the report. I'm pleased to report that improvements have been made during the audit process through the completion of six of the seven internal audit recommendations. The remaining area of improvement relates to ensuring that documentation is complete and accessible for each housing project, which we acknowledge as being challenging in light of the size and complexity of the programme. The Audit Committee is therefore invited to review the contents of the audit report and endorse the agreed audit recommendations that have been agreed by management.
Thank you. Do we have any questions or comments? Councillor Smale.
There's a hint here that there may be some weakness in our systems regarding the interrelationship between buildings under construction and just finished and then achieving insurance cover. And I just wonder if we could have a general comment as to what risks we're running with the programme in terms of insurance, obviously things like the risk of arson, which we've experienced.
Mr. Fairley.
To my knowledge, during the construction phase, the responsibility for insurance of the works completed would sit with a contractor, and a handover to the council. Then we would then take arrangements to have them covered under our insurance. My understanding now is that the arrangements to make sure that that's done effectively and efficiently and timelessly is now in place. So that risk that was identified during the audit has been addressed.
Mr. Devine.
On page 57 out of 292, 3.4, the following examples of good practice were found. Yeah. Progress reports are reported to Cabinet Council every 6 to 12 months, and the service now have regular meetings with councillors. So what happened before? Is this now really very recently, or has it been going on for a long time?
Could you repeat the page number?
I think it's page 67 on the larger pack at the top.
292, yes.
Yeah, so the first bullet point in terms of 3.4, so just for clarification, this relates to phase two of the programme. So one of the things that there was a lessons learned review as part of the phase one terms of the programme, And we noted that the regular meetings, just to kind of keep the keep the councillors, relevant councillors, made aware of progress in relation to the housing programme, that was now a regular feature. So it's something that we could see as evidence from lessons learned from some phase one, where maybe the communication flows were not quite so readily available. So that was quite a significant improvement and recognised as a good practice.
Any other comments or questions? I think, generally, it's an encouraging report and a good good example of internal audit actually making a difference to the... I think management were quite happy with that and the positive input from internal audit. So, well done to the internal audit team.
I'll pass back that to the team members in terms of their contributions. Thank you.
Ms. Stacey, it's you again. The follow-up review of the audit recommendations.
Thank you, Chair. This is one of our regular reports to this committee around following up those recommendations that are shown as completed on the Pintana performance management system. So again, this report has been discussed in advance with the Chief Executive, Directors and Heads of Service at our Corporate Management Team Strategic Leaders Group meeting held on the 29th of August this year. So each year, as part of the follow-up process, we select a sample of internal audit recommendations to determine whether they've been completed satisfactorily. And to give assurance to management and indeed this committee on the continuous improvement of internal controls and governance arrangement, which is a really important part. Within this report, we selected a sample of 59 recommendations, which we reviewed, and we reviewed the evidence that was obtained to support the completion of each recommendation. This revealed that 52 recommendations had been satisfactorily completed, 88% of the sample, though 7 required further work, the 12% remaining, as detailed in Appendix 1 of the report. And as a result, we've raised further recommendations to ensure that the original areas of improvement are indeed addressed through the full completion of recommendation, and we've agreed revised completion dates with management, and these are shown in Appendix 2. The Audit Committee is invited to review the contents of the audit report and agree, endorse the audit recommendations that have been agreed by management. And just by way of information, although we can't provide a direct comparison due to the varying sample of audit recommendations selected each time, this follow-up review does compare favourably with the previous year's report that was presented to this committee in December 2017. 52 recommendations were tested, 71% of those were found to have been completed satisfactorily, 29 were identified as not being complete. So again, there is a trend around management completion of the recommendations. So I think some positive assurances there. Happy to take any particular questions.
Councillor Smale.
Yes, just linked to item one, arrears relative to our own staff. This was stubbornly not much lower than £1 million. I just wonder if you would comment on where we think we are financially in terms of this problem.
I don't have to hand, so I'll look to get that information and provide it to the committee.
Thank you.
Can we note an action for that, please? Councillor Milligan.
I'll just follow up for Peter's area, and it is the arrears, and I'm sure Mr. Turpey will be aware that I have been asking some questions lately While I think it's right that we try to recover debt, I have some serious misgivings over where we stand on the data protection issues here, where effectively we're writing to managers telling them to start disciplinary action against staff because they have rent arrears or council tax arrears. And that seriously worries me when I hear that staff in adult social care are being sent letters from their managers telling them that they have arrears in housing and rent arrears and council tax arrears. And I just actually question where we are with the data protection rules surrounding that. Now, I think we should be doing everything we can to get the money back for anybody who's not just doing staff, but I have a problem with that. I'm surprised to see again in the monitoring of the external care homes, which is item 4 on the report, where we're still identifying that some external care homes are still notifying us without using egress. I thought that was a loophole that had been shut some time ago. I just asked for some comments on that. I thought we had been quite strong on that with external care homes.
Mr Turpey, could you take the Data Protection Act request?
Certainly, Chair. I think one of my other roles as Data Protection Officer, I'm very keen to, in fact, statutorily obliged to try and keep the Council from committing data breaches rather than encouraging them to do so. I've had discussion, I'm aware of Councillor Milligan's questioning to this matter, and I think it's quite right to do so. It's important we get the data protection side right. I've worked with my principal solicitor, William Venters, to go through the process we use at the moment, and we are happy that it is compliant with data protection. That's not to say that it can't be improved, and we are going to work with HR to see if we can move it on from there. The process is such that no one owing money to the council should be unaware that they may, this matter, if it's not paid, may be escalated through HR and management. Unfortunately, people in that position may sometimes adopt the head in the sand approach, and it suddenly comes as really a quite unnecessary. You know, I'm full of sympathy for people who suddenly find themselves called in to speak to their line manager, expecting to be at something completely different, and suddenly realise that their indebtedness to the council is what's on the table, and that shouldn't happen. The process we have won't let it happen if people are acting reasonably. I think we've got to try and step that process up to make sure we can deal with this in as considerate and confidential way as possible. We do take the concerns being made to us quite clear. I think just saying simply that we're complying with the law isn't enough in this area, and we have to look to try and go that step further with our colleagues.
Alan, as the data protection officer, is also the senior legal figure we have in the council, so I have to take that advice from him. I've got to say, I struggle to see that it does comply. However, I'll accept the advice given.
You deal with the Cameron question.
I suppose just picking up as well in terms of the staff debt, there is a systematic process that goes through that. There's a number of letters which goes out to staff encouraging their involvement. There's staff counselling that's offered as well, sort of thing. So I guess I'm just reinforcing the point that Alan made there. I would not want audit committee to think that there is simply people are called into a meeting. There is a systematic process that's gone through to support staff to be in a position to pay back their debt.
Councillor Muirhead.
I think the concern isn't the level of support that's given to people or how they're approached. It's how you get the information in the first place. It's that exchange of information from our revenues, I suppose, to our the supervision, if you like, that implement that. I think that's the concern that we've got in terms of the exposure that we might have in terms of data protection legislation.
I think the two are intrinsically linked, Chair. It's we have, in any way of collecting or using information, we have to let people know why we're going to collect it, what we're going to use it for, and that is made clear in the chief of correspondence that would follow someone who has staff indebtedness with the council. They will be given print of opportunity to be told that, you know, that, that the information will be shared with HR, because staff indebtedness is a disciplinary matter in terms of the code of conduct. It's part of the people policies that were brought in 2 years ago.
So I'll pick up the about the care homes, which was the noting that the use of egress. It remains a frustration for us that they're not using egress, and we're picking up through contract management. As I say, we have an action to bring that into line. So it's something we continue to do, and we share the frustrations that this information has been shared by egress. We will come back with an update as well in the next audit.
I think when the original report came to audit committee, we were questioning whether there was some form of sanction to be used against those who are not using the system correctly, as in, unless you put the invoice through egress, it won't get paid, and that sort of thing, whether that's been explored. But you can perhaps cover that when you do the follow-up. Do you have any other questions or comments? In which case, moving on, the counter-fraud annual report. Ms. Stacey.
Thank you, Chair. This report is our annual report to this committee in recognition of this committee's remit to have oversight over the Council's counter-fraud arrangements. So again, this report has been discussed in advance with the Chief Executive Directors and Heads of Service at a Corporate Management Team Strategic Leadership Group meeting held on the 12th of September. The purpose of the report is to provide an update to the Audit Committee on the Council's counter-fraud responsibilities and a clarification around those, and also setting out some of the activities of the Corporate Fraud Team over the past year as part of the arrangements to tackling fraud at the Council. Section 2 of the report, within the background, sets out the high level, the responsibilities of management for prevention, detection and investigation arrangements in tackling fraud, sets out the Corporate Fraud Team's responsibility to support management discharge those duties. It sets out the internal audit role in terms of providing assurance around the prevention, detection controls and the efficacy of those controls, and indeed this committee's remit in terms of oversight of all of these arrangements. Section 3 sets out in summary form the main areas of work undertaken by the Corporate Fraud Team in collaboration with the relevant personnel in service areas, and this is in line with the Council's counter-fraud policy and strategy. The activity associated with the National Fraud Initiative provides an update to that reported to this committee in December 2017. In summary, the activity during the year has led to identified savings of around £1 million. £930,000 of that relates to housing tenancy. That's not a cashable element. I think we've provided some clarification to management and this committee previously. We're utilising for benchmarking purposes the guidance from Audit Scotland on the cost avoidance of detecting housing tenancy fraud. But it also includes a number of other areas where 97,000 fraud have been. So clearly there are benefits to the Council and its stakeholders from this work. In the context of the Council's annual expenditure, it should provide some assurance on the effectiveness of counter-fraud controls and the Council's response to tackling fraud, which needs to be proportionate to the risks and recognise the resources that are available. The Audit Committee is asked to consider the work undertaken and note the outcomes. I think just for some background information, as part of our counter-fraud activity. The plan that was approved by this committee in March, we will be reviewing the counter-fraud policy and strategy. At the moment, those documents are published on the internet and they're available to all officers of the Council to apply within their service areas. We're also preparing to embark on the National Fraud Initiative for 2018-19, which includes some new data sets and some new public sector partners that are expected to participate. It's intended to raise awareness of these outcomes from the previous NFI exercise across the Midlothian community in the hope that this will act as a deterrent, and we'll use this as part of our participation in the NFI exercise for 2018-19. And also the corporate fraud team are progressing with the areas outlined in the corporate fraud activity within the plan approved by this committee. Happy to take any particular questions about the report. Thanks.
Councillor Smale.
This is obviously a very commendable result in terms of particularly the retention of council houses that were not properly let. I just wondered if I could ask a general question. Are we conscious of an increasing tendency to illegal sublets in Midlothian? The second question, more specific, to item 3.5, where we say that in the matter of housing benefit overpayment, this action resulted in a housing benefit overpayment of over 14,000. Now, if that's a single case, then somebody was able to fly under the radar for perhaps 4 or 5 years. I wonder if that's the case or whether that's a number of benefit overpayments. So two questions there. One is about, are we becoming conscious of illegal subletting? And secondly, this specific housing benefit overpayment, was it a single case over a long number of years?
Okay, in terms of the subletting question, not specifically to Midlothian, but through our network of fraud investigations across other Scottish local authorities, we've actually included a piece of work on our counter-fraud activity for 18-19 on exactly that matter. So if you refer back to what was approved by this committee, we will be using some local data match information between council tax and the housing rent system to identify potential subletting of council properties. We're very aware in terms of that risk, and hopefully that will provide some assurance when we report on the results of that work in this equivalent port for 18-19. The second question around the matches for the housing benefit one.
So yes, was it a single case?
Appendix?
It's sitting in 3.5 at 14,000, and in your table, it's the third column down, 14,602.
Oh yeah. So my understanding is that is one individual case. We brought this to the attention, and actually we've had feedback from the DWP around the housing benefit overpayment. But there's also other aspects in terms of other benefits that they're pursuing in terms of an overpayment. But my understanding that was one case.
Can we be sure it was an isolated incident? Maybe it was someone with a huge income received in cash who wasn't part of the national insurance system. Is there anything more you can tell me about that?
I don't know the specific details. Sorry.
Councillor Milligan.
Thank you.
Sorry, Muir Head.
This is just going to go on and on. The referrals to the, you know, about the council housing, are they all, is that subletting, or is it situations where the houses are just not occupied? Because you know, Peter's asking the question about, is this a recurring or an increasing issue? I've certainly over the piece reported three relatively recently, three houses that were unoccupied, and I suspect that some of them may be in the other 44 here, because sometimes it's quite difficult to actually prove that there's nobody living in them if they happen to come back to the properties on a periodic basis, pick up mail, respond to letters, drops and things like that. Are the ones that we're talking about here, the 10, is it actually subletting issues, or is it non-occupancy, if you like?
Again, don't know the specific breakdown, but as you mentioned, it is a particular challenge, and I think I would say to this committee that we have a very good working relationship with the housing service, and that really helps us monitor this on a regular basis and look at a number of different data sources to gather some evidence to counteract some of the claims, as you've mentioned, come through to say no, it was. These are occupied, so it is quite a challenging activity. But I think that we're aware of the risk and are aware of these occasions where subletting has happened. And I think the positive thing is, having detected it and dealt with it and taken the appropriate action, we allow these properties, to be released to individuals that, have an entitlement, and indeed helps, with some of those in terms of the waiting list. And it's those factors that feed into the saving calculation because of the costs associated with local authorities. What I will do is some of the particular issues raised around subletting by the committee members. We can include that as specific elements within the scope of the counter fraud activity and provide some specific assurances around how the risks are being mitigated as part of that, if you feel that would be helpful going forward.
I'm still not clear if what I'm trying to get at is a. Is it all about subletting? What's being concentrated on here, the subletting issue, as opposed to non-occupancy? Because, as I say, that's the common thing. I mean, it's probably more difficult for neighbours, for instance, to identify that a property is being sublet. If it's empty, that's another matter. And I suspect that a fair number of if it's about non-occupancy, then a fair number of the 44 that have gone nowhere could be because it's not provable that it's empty or it's being sublet. So I think while I didn't agree with I didn't understand the 93,000, I think I've raised that here before. How we get to that kind of savings figure, it's still a lot of money on their calculations, but it could be a lot more, I think, because I wouldn't mind some additional information on that, just to kind of get a wee bit more, know the specifics, but, what happened in the 44 other cases? What was it actually proven beyond a doubt that the houses were occupied or were not sublet or whatever, or whether it was just difficult to prove that there was a problem there?
So certainly what we can do going forward to enhance some of the detail is look at trends and indeed some of the analysis that sits below how the summary data, if that would be again helpful to the committee around assurances and areas of risk.
Councillor Smale and Councillor Hardy.
Yes, on Councillor Muirhead's point, there certainly is a problem with people not occupying their houses, and one symptom of that is the list that the Housing Department have of those who refuse us access to test their gas boilers, which we have a statutory right to do, and I think there'll be a high correlation between that category and houses that have been temporarily abandoned when people go down south to work for high wages, but they want to hang on to their council house up here.
Councillor Hardy?
Yeah, obviously, what struck me was that the figure of cash savings, £97,288, after we'd taken the theoretical value of the houses out of the equation, It doesn't seem a particularly large figure. And if we're employing a fraud officer full-time, or the equivalent full-time, to do these investigations, there'll no doubt be costs involved in the investigations, and I'm just concerned that are we actually achieving value for money out of this? I'm not obviously a fan of fraud, but whether or not there might be a method of outsourcing or something where we could achieve perhaps the same savings for less money, because it doesn't strike me as a particularly large figure, and once the cost of employment and investigations and everything would be taken into account, it doesn't strike me like we're really saving very much at all.
The primary objective in terms of our counter fraud policy is not to generate savings necessarily from our activity. It's really to provide assurances that our arrangements in place are robust, and if we do detect fraud, that we investigate that in a thorough fashion, and that in itself acts as a bit of a deterrent from those. I think the conversations with the Scottish Local Authority fraud investigators is this is actually quite low return from my perspective. Is I think that provides positive assurance around how effective some of the controls that we've got in place at Midlothian Council. I think in my introduction I highlighted it is about recognising the resources that are available and ensuring that we're using that resource to target areas where we feel that there is the kind of vulnerability in terms of fraud. So actually I think the response would be overarching, that this does provide some positive assurance on the how robust our counter fraud arrangements are.
I think there's an element of deterrence in there as well that's perhaps not capable of being given a financial benefit. But, of course, there's also the unknown benefit, although the 93,000 over 4 years, the 930,000 in return in the houses to the stock is a notional figure. There is definitely some benefit there in that 10 houses are now, or 10 families are now housed, who wouldn't otherwise have been and were probably costing us something somewhere else.
I think the other aspect in terms of response to Councillor Hardy's question is that during this year we will be reviewing the Council's counter-fraud policy and strategy, and the proposal would be to bring that back through this committee. So, if we can have some discussion around resource risk, that's an opportunity when we're looking at our policy framework to evaluate, do we think we've got the right balance? I think there will be an opportunity going forward to look at that in detail. And we can provide some comparisons with similar councils across Scotland, again, if that would be helpful.
Councillor Milligan.
Thank you. It's just following on for Councillor Hardy's point, and it is about whether or not this is really best value for us, because I just think the £930,000 that we've saved there is coming for a layman, it's an absolute myth. And it can be judged and balanced on if the 10 houses we got back, if the 10 people or the 10 families we put into the houses were all in bed and breakfast that this council was having to pay for, then I can see that. However, if they were all staying with their mum and dad, I can find no saving in here at all. Similarly, if they were in private lets that were being paid through housing benefit, again, maybe to the public purse it says, but it's the same. If all 10 of them were occupied by illegal tenants and they were put out in the street, then the council have to pick them up as well. So I'm not just sure without having the facts in there, and even at that, at £930,000, I'm sorry, but only an accountant could come up with that figure for that. When you then look at, for example, the single person discount saving the £54,000, I'm going to assume that's something that's run off quite regular and doesn't take an awful lot of work today. And again, and the other big figure, the £14,000, that was one one person, all bar £600 of that. So I think we really need to look at the back of that to see whether or no we're getting best value. And I take Joel's point that this isn't a set up to make us money or to generate money. It's there to deter people, but it's about weighing up the size of your counter-fraud team, and I can't say that I know what size it is at the moment, but it's about having a clear direction now whether it is value for money and we're getting value for money from it.
One person.
It's two individuals that half of their time is counter-fraud activity, the other half is on internal audit activity, so it's a one full-time equivalent in relation to our corporate fraud resource, which is fairly minimal, so maybe
that would give me the assurance I needed. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions or comments? If there's not, we'll move on to risk management. Ms. Lawson.
Thank you very much, Chair. The report before Audit Committee this afternoon presents the Quarter 1 Risk Management Update, covering the period 1st of April to 30th of June. The report focuses on the risks, current issues and opportunities before the Council. The report highlights the financial challenges facing the Council and the UK decision to leave the European Union. The current issues facing the Council are summarised on page 90 of the report, highlighting financial stability, the importance of the change programme and welfare reform. The highest risks facing the Council are also reported, setting out balancing the budget in future years, the growing Council, Scottish Abuse Inquiry, the Historic Abuse Claims Project. The remainders can be seen on that page. There are a number of opportunities before the Council. These are presented on page 91. And these are the Growing Council, City Deal, Shaw Fair, Borders Rail, Easter Bush and Creating a World-Class Education System. The report provides commentary on the highest issues facing the Council and the opportunities and risks, but with the full detailed register attached as Appendix 1 from page 97 onwards. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Councillor Smale.
Briefly, in view of our discussion earlier of review and pay and grading, where you say at 2.7.4 on my page 88, which might be page 90 for other people, during 2016, Midlothian Council made an investment of £2.67 million. I think that figure in Gary's table is the long-term cost in the later years of that programme. I don't think it particularly matters, but you would perhaps want to tie that up. You leave the question open as to whether pay and grading is producing the result, and I think I heard from Gary Fairley that we would have incurred quite a lot of that cost anyhow through outsourcing and agency working, but I think we should perhaps make that paragraph be consistent with what we've heard earlier in the day.
Some of the detail that's contained within the appendix, you're quite right to raise that, but one of the reasons that this was highlighted as a risk to the organisation was to make sure that the organisation got that level of assurity that the return on investment was there and it hadn't spent all this additional money and the organisation hadn't reaped the benefit back for it.
Do we have any other questions, comments? I note that the impact of Brexit is something that the, quote, Council will have to start giving consideration to. We're 6 months out. Is it needing a little bit more strength behind that impetus?
We're just approaching the quarter two risk management reviews, and one of the things that will be coming up in discussions with heads of service will be what the anticipated impact of the range of outcomes could be and how their services are preparing for that. But one of the things that we're trying to do is try and articulate how some other large public sector organisations are starting to prepare.
Thank you. If There's no other questions on the risk report? Councillor Smail?
Just very briefly, the HM government announced an extra £200 billion for the NHS a couple of months back. I'm just wondering if any of that is going to filter through to the IJB, and have we any further clarity on how that might positively affect Midlothian?
I'll take a swing at that, but without being definite. So normally the Barnett consequentials of any increase from Westminster would see the Barnett consequentials come through to NHS in Scotland with an expectation that that will then filter through. How Scottish Government then decide to allocate that resource, we don't have that level of clarity yet, but we would expect any Barnett consequentials to flow through.
Thank you very much. In that case, no other questions on that. Thank you. The external audit report, Mr. Reid.
Thank you, Chair. The annual audit report, both before the committee today, summarises the key findings and conclusions from our work in the second year of our appointment. And supports the committee and members of the committee in consideration of the financial statements and also in their governance responsibilities today. The report has been agreed with management and is presented here in draft following finalisation of the financial statements and approval of those. I'll sign the opinion on the financial statements. The report will be finalised and then will be shared with Audit Scotland for publication on their website. As members are hopefully aware, there are two broad responsibilities in my role as your external auditor. One is to consider the financial statements and to provide a true and fair opinion on the financial statements. And the other element of my responsibilities under the Code of Audit Practice is to consider the wider scope aspects or dimensions of public audit. Clearly, the wider scope aspects of public audit and that consideration complements the work on the financial statements. So turning to the financial statements and that part of the audit, I can confirm that I intend to issue an unqualified opinion on the Council and Group financial statements and that we have concluded satisfactorily in respect of all the elements of the work that we had to undertake and specifically in respect of the audit significant risks that we set out within the annual audit plan. Members will recall, and I think it was at the one of the very recent meetings, I intimated the fact that in response to the identified fraud, we had revised our risk assessment in respect of the audit work that we had to undertake. And in particular, we enhanced the testing undertaken around non-payroll expenditure, reducing the testing thresholds to increase both the quantum and the value of the items that were selected for our sample testing. In addition to that, we also looked to agree the expenditure remittances to bank and also evaluated some of the expenditure within commercial operations and property and facilities management services departments and whether that was in line with the procurement decisions and whether the procurement framework was followed. We also, as I set out within the report, undertook additional procedures around supplier contracts and examining the procurement process behind material suppliers and reviewing unusual movements between 16-17 and 17-18. I'm pleased to report that that did not highlight any matters that I need to draw to the committee's attention and that we didn't identify any matters as a result of revenue and expenditure recognition or indeed any material matters of management override of control. We have identified 12 audit adjustments with a net aggregate impact of some £6.5 million on the comprehensive income and expenditure statement. And these are set out both within my report and the detail within the appendices there, but also in the Section 95 officers covering paper. There was one unadjusted audit difference, which management took the view that it wasn't material to adjust, and I've concurred with that view, and therefore it does not require to be adjusted. There was also a number of presentational adjustments made to the financial statements as a result of the audit, and these have been corrected by management. I would like to draw to the committee's attention that there was good cooperation provided by the Section 95 officer and his team and other officers across the council, and good positive engagement in the audit process. And I want to thank officers for their engagement and for supporting me and my team's responsibilities and allowing us to discharge those responsibilities. Nonetheless, I have made comments in the report around the timeliness of the preparation of the financial statements and the fact that those could be enhanced, and also the fact that significant improvements continue to be required to the financial reporting process. A number of the themes that I identify in this year's annual audit report are consistent with some matters, or many matters, identified in the 16-17 audit. Within the appendices is an action plan, and I've set out a number of Grade 1 and Grade 2 recommendations concerned with the preparation and the quality assurance arrangements over the financial statements, and in addition to that, aspects of internal financial control. Turning now, Chair, to the wider scope aspects of my audit responsibilities, and I set out within the remainder of my report the key considerations and findings there, and set out within the executive summary my conclusions in respect to the four dimensions. Turning firstly to financial management, I've graded that overall as a red in terms of the rating. Noting that, similar to prior years, the Council has failed to operate within approved budgets, and that there is continued work required to ensure that the budgets are robust and realistic. There was also challenges again this year in delivery against the capital plan and slippage in the capital projects. And again, given the importance of capital investment in the transformation agenda, then failure to deliver and set realistic budgets does have the impact, the potential to impact and impede the delivery of change. I've also noted that there are continued improvements required over financial reporting arrangements to continue and to better support budget holders in their roles. And in my view, there's also a need for the Council to support and to review the level of skills and capacity across finance and integrated support services to ensure that they do remain appropriate to support the Council in the journey ahead through and the service transformation that is required. In respect of financial sustainability, again, my overall grading is red. The Council, I've noted, continues to face acute financial pressures, and significant progress, I've noted, is urgently required to deliver not only on the approved 2018-19 recovery plan, but also to support the approval of a robust budget in February in relation to 19-20 and going forward. There are significant funding gaps, and those remain over the period to 2022-23. And I've noted that in order to balance the budget in the medium to the longer term, that difficult decisions will need to be taken to achieve that financial balance. And there's also a need for significant improvement in the pace of transformation, supported by enhanced scrutiny and reporting to members. I note in relation to financial sustainability that the Council is projecting that the uncommitted general fund reserve at the 31st of March 2019 could be of the order of £1.7 million. And again, note that that poses a significant risk to the Council and does provide limited ability to respond to unforeseen events. Turning then to governance and transparency, I've noted overall governance and transparency as an amber rating, recording my view that in terms of the overall framework and structures, there is an effective framework in place, notwithstanding the fact that there are a number of improvements and aspects of the internal control framework that requires to be improved. I've also noted within this section of the report the ongoing investigation into the Council's Road Division, which identified some £2.1 million of payments over a seven-year period that were made to a contractor that wasn't on the Council's procurement framework. I've highlighted a number of weaknesses were identified as a result of that and span over the seven-year period, and the fact that the investigation is ongoing and matters have been referred to Police Scotland. In respect to value for money and the areas focused on in value for money, overall I've graded that as a green, noted some positives, notwithstanding the challenges facing the Council and Midlothian in terms of the population rates and the changes in demographics, and that those will bring significant challenges. I have noted the degree of investment and the future opportunities potentially around City Deal, and indeed the degree of engagement and recognition that management has over the challenges in Midlothian with those demographic changes. I've considered the Single Midlothian Plan and indeed how the Council's transformation programme and service plan outline how the Council intends to deliver its contribution to the Single Midlothian Plan and the routes for scrutiny through Cabinet Performance Review and Scrutiny Committees. And also noted in relation to the local government benchmarking framework some of the fluctuation in performance since 2011-12, but that the Council is performing well in relation to public performance reporting, and there is that commitment to being open and transparent. I've highlighted within the action plan a number of recommendations which also align to the wider scope aspects of the audit and the findings there. Management have provided responses to all of the recommendations within the action plan. Clearly, as members will recall, the 18-19 year is a year of best value, and there will be a number of aspects which undoubtedly will be picked up as part of the scoping exercise when that is undertaken over the next few months with colleagues from Audit Scotland in relation to the 18-19 best value assurance review of the Council. Within the appendices, I set out other areas I'm required to report to you in the context of my responsibilities and under auditing standards, both in relation to independence, the responsibilities of you and the Council, and also in respect of fees. With those comments, Chair, very happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, it's not so much a question as maybe a comment. Obviously, I think we all knew we had some very heavy challenges in front of us, and I think that's been really apparent for when the Council back setting the 16-17 budget set a budget overspending dramatically. Rather than taking the decisions back then, we always knew that we were going to be faced with a harder challenge when we were spending over £4 million or £4 million more than what we had coming in, and the usable reserves were being absolutely diminished, and I think that was really, really clear. The one thing this report highlights is probably a point that's been getting made time after time after time, that we've seen budgets coming forward and being approved that then quite simply aren't deliverable. And some of the areas, for example, I'll use, are the areas where we restructured, where savings were going to be made, but by the time we came to restructuring, that somewhere on the corporate management team had taken the decision to move these vacancies to about June, which lost us money that was now recoverable again. And you can see this in the recovery plan. One of the things I'm really wanting to emphasise, I have spoke to the Chief Executive and others, when we come forward with budget proposals this year, they need to be bankers. Sorry, layman's terms, but they need to be bankers. They're no could-bes, have-bes. So if you're coming forward with restructuring, I want to know at that stage what we're restructuring, what we're taking out of the service, at what span do we need that. And I'll give an example of this for layman's terms. You're looking in the recovery plan, where we're talking about the active schools team, where we're talking about taking out 7 full-time active schools coordinators and replacing them with 2 sports development officers. I want to know that the savings in there, can we meet them with a 90-day notice for the change of staff, the negotiations all have to be in there. I want to see in there the proof that that can actually can be made, and it's about doing that. I think genuinely we've always known we've had to pick up the pace of transformation. The problem I think that we always see is that picking up a pace of transformation at the same time as we're having that level of scrutiny can sometimes clash with each other, but it's really important that we do. We need to look at doing the budget in a completely different way. We can't continue along this lines of just sticking stuff up and salami slicing it right along the top. That's just not working. This council really needs to look at areas where we are quite frankly delivering a service that's perhaps wanted, that's maybe nice to have, but the reality is now, can we afford it given the demographic challenges, the education challenges that we've got? We've been a growing authority. And it's quite clearly no. We have a capital plan there that's massively ambitious, but massively short of the money to deliver that ambition. So I think we'll have to be really clear. There are some good steps being taken. We now have a vacancy freeze, a financial unnecessary spend policy or directorate in place just now. And I think it's really important that we focus on making sure that the recovery plan, and I've got to stress this again, I see the recovery plan and I've listened to officers where they talk about we need to recover £3.7 million, the figures I have in front of me, over £3 million. The real figure we need to recover is over £5 million. That's where we're overspent. Because there are some favourable movements in there to make it £3 million, doesn't it make it? The overspend is over £5 million. And that's what we need to be drawing down. And we're not wanting to come back here with, oh, we've managed to balance the budget because we've had some favourable movements. Because you can see in this report here, given some areas a favourable movement for us, we would have had an overspend of well in addition to £600,000. So we need to be really honest with ourselves and make sure that the budget's there. It's hoped that along the political lines we seem to be working a bit better now, cross-party. And that's sad, I think, and hopefully we'll gather pace given the criticality that we're at. So hopefully we can come forward and see if the next budgets can be delivered, if no cross-party, if there are areas where we can work that we can agree, and then there's going to be areas where we'll disagree. That's quite clear, political differences will come in there. But I think as closely as we can work to deliver the areas that we can all agree on. The one thing that I think and hope that the Officer Corps are getting for this is the same as I do. You know, sitting reading paper, newspapers that are talking about us being in a critical position, isn't it? It's no healthy for us. It's no what we want to leave. It's no what our staff want to see, and it's no what our customers want to see. So we really need to get moving on that. So hopefully, with the report in front of us, there'll be a learning curve here, and we should all make sure that we're going forward positively on this, and not just seeing this as a negative, seeing it as a wake-up call.
Councillor Hardy.
I would completely concur with Councillor Milligan on that point. I thought it was quite telling that last week we had a performance review and scrutiny committee, and every single paper within that committee showed an overspend. And I think we really need to be setting realistic budgets, as Councillor Milligan said, but making sure that those budgets are adhered to. We can't have another year where our budget is seen as a vague target and not very limited attempt to adhere to it is made, and then we have a recovery plan delivered after the first quarter. That's unacceptable, and that can't happen again.
And Councillor Muirhead had a question.
You got the name right. Yep, I was waiting on that. I thought you would get it right this time. Did you write it down? The fact that we were, I think, as you say, sitting here after the first quarter having to put in a recovery plan, well, certainly came as quite a shock to me, and I think one of the concerning things is I think it probably came as a shock to some of the staff as well, some of the managers, some of the officers that are responsible for delivering these budgets. And I think one of the things we need to make sure is that, I suppose, secondary to us being able to have a knowledge of what's going on a
month-by-month, almost week-by-week basis. Certainly, officers of the council responsible for delivering the savings that they've said they're going to make have that information available to them on a regular basis as well, and no have to wait till after the end of a quarter to determine that they've got an issue. Because by that time, by the time you put a recovery plan into effect, you've then lost almost lost the quarter you're in. So you're halfway through the year before you can really start to see these recoveries being implemented. So there has to be a better way, as far as I can see, of making sure that officers have got the tools to enable them to take the actions they need to take to keep budgets and things like that on track. Derek mentioned the fact that the parties and the council getting on a bit better, and I certainly hope that we're able to work together to effect a better budget. And it's not just about putting together a budget, because I think if we're in a situation where we can identify savings, then we shouldn't be waiting till budget time to implement them. I think the quicker, if we can, you know, get common agreement across the political areas of the council on particular savings, then the quicker we implement them, the better. You know, if you're going to, Derek keeps saying this, but if you've got to be doing it next year, better doing it this year. If you've got to be closing something or stopping doing something or adjusting the way that you do something in a year's time, you're better doing it now and realising the savings as soon as possible. So I certainly hope that that we can work a bit better together and, as I say, agree these things a wee bit more in advance.
Dr. Vickers.
Thank you. I'd just like to thank also Stephen and his team for such a robust report. And I think the council leader is correct. It's how we move forward as a result of this. And for me, I'm taking this report as the creation of a real sense of urgency around both the financial management and financial sustainability. We also talked about the capital plan, and Gary presented the capital plan to a seminar this month. So it's really important that we make sure that we're not just keeping our eye on the revenue budget, but it has to be capital and revenue, given that we're growing so much. And an assurance to you that I think moving forward, I absolutely agree that we cannot salami slice budgets. We need to take a holistic look at the services that we deliver, particularly in terms of what we're going to need for the growing demand, both in terms of adult health and social care, but also in terms of education, and really begin to look at what we absolutely need to deliver for individuals and communities that we serve, because we need to move forward and deliver essential services. So you have my assurance in terms of the sense of urgency. And when we get to the next report, I've also got a slight amendment to make to the final paragraph of that, which I hope will add that sense of urgency to that too.
Councillor Smale.
I'd like to address the question of scrutiny, and there was some suggestion that there should be more scrutiny here, and certainly I agree with Councillor Muirhead that we should be able to respond more rapidly. However, as we're currently constituted, if I ask the Section 95 officer in June, have we had an overspend the first quarter, you necessarily say, well, I don't really know, and this will be presented later. I'm just wondering if we can have a flash system so that you're not hidebound by the need for accuracy, but we can identify these general drifts so that we can react much faster than we hitherto have done.
Dr. Vickers.
Thank you. We've been currently looking at the use of data analytics. It's a tool that Ernst & Young also use in terms of laying that over. We have that for staff absence, for example, at the minute. So a tool where managers could see at a glance where they're beginning to spend and where that's beginning to go off kilter. And we would hope to have that in place, if not monthly, weekly would absolutely really help budget holders in order to monitor that progress moving forward. So the IT team are currently looking at those data analytics for me, and they're going to present that back to me, I think, next week, so that we can begin to see what that looks like. But we certainly can't have managers going through sheets and sheets in terms of Excel, and we need to make sure that they have an at-a-glance what they've actually spent within that week or within that month. And financial discipline is going to be key moving forward.
Mr. Devink.
Well, first of all, can I congratulate Ernst & Young by producing a really very, very impressive report. There are quite a lot of things that have already been raised that I would have total agreement with, and it's very encouraging to hear Dr. Vickers to say what she has said. However, there are a number of things that I would like to raise, if I may, in your account, in your report. And they are as follows. I know there are a whole lot of them that are quite small issues. It would be nice to know what Pacific Shelf 826 is.
Mr. Fairley.
Pacific Shelf 826 is a holding company, a shell company that we set up by the council. That really goes back to the early days of the Shawfair landholding. So both ourselves and Edinburgh Council set up a company to hold the asset at that point. The land was then transferred back to the council and the whole development has moved forward where we've moved the land on to the various developers. We still hold that company. It holds no assets. The intention really is to wind that company up over the medium term, but it really is dormant.
Then I have got on page 143 out of 292 a number of issues that I feel are worth just standing still by. Similarly to prior year, the council is not operator is in approved budget. We have heard that. And now, of course, we will try everything that we can do to do so. However, if one looks at some of the things that are produced, I'm really quite worried. And particularly on page 147 out of 292, where it says, in our view, improvements remain to be made over financial reporting arrangement to support budget holders and members of their roles. When you say members of their roles, could you just explain that a little bit more?
Through you, Chair, I think the point has been well elucidated in the meeting today in relation to the timeliness, principally, and the nature of reporting that's provided both to officers and to elected members, and that's the point that I'm making within that part of the report.
And then on page 149, this is probably, you know, budget shortfalls. The budget gap, best case scenario, worst case scenario. If we have got anything to go by, in the past, it is the worst case scenario that we have been facing, and that would then mean a 41 million shortfall by 2022-23. I mean, it just doesn't bear almost believing. However, I then read just a little bit lower, and that took me really my breath away because I had to read it into the Ernst & Young report, that the Section 95 officer had written to the chief executive in June of this year to tell him that he was very concerned. Now, is that not something that would have been coming to the audit committee? Because surely the audit committee is, in my view, very much responsible for that kind of thing. But maybe Mr. Turpey could give us a view as to why this never saw the light of day as far as the audit committee is concerned.
Mr. Turpey?
I'm slightly... That would not normally cross my desk as a matter of course, Mr. Devink.
Dr. Vickers.
I can come up just to say after I took up post on the 1st of August, I did within my first few weeks respond to the Section 95 officer in terms of that memo. Part of that is referred to in this audit report, and a large part of that was the recovery plans that we committed to bring forward to October Council. So all of the points that were raised in that memo I did respond to as Chief Exec, and I'm happy to share that memo with the Audit Committee if they would like a copy.
Then I'm going to come on. I'm sorry, but this is the one and only chance that we have got to deal with something as important as the Ernst & Young report. page 150, recommendation 10. I'm really enormously encouraged by that and by recommendation 11. Now we come to page 153, governance and transparency. And, you know, I know we have been told that we can't really talk much about procurement and all the other things, but in September last year, September 2017, that's more than, well, it's a year ago, the very first whistleblower came forward. And now, 12 months later, we really haven't got any clue what is happening. I still believe that if we have no loss, there is nothing that we can sue about, but that is something that probably other people don't agree with. But it would be very helpful if we could at least get an idea without us frustrating the Her Majesty's police force activity as far as this is concerned.
I understand that that paragraph there about the commencement of the investigation, Ms. Stacey, is there an Mr. Reid, is there an adjustment on the wording there?
Yeah, I mean, the paragraph stands, but there was a late amendment suggested by the Chief Internal Auditor just in relation to the indication of the commencement in the investigation. So I think it's a totally different matter, Chair, than the matter that's being raised.
May I continue? Sorry, I apologise for taking up the time. Value for money, page 158. I'm really disappointed that the only thing that I would regret that you have never raised is that we within the council are paying £10 million a year. £10 million a year, it's a staggering sum of money to fund every year the PPP contracts. Now, I have said in the past, it must be possible to look at these contracts and find if it isn't worth our while to look at the possibility of making very significant inroads. I'm not believing that you can take the £10 million away, but I have a very good reason to believe that other people that have had the same contracts, they have hired people to look into these and to sort them out, and they have made huge, huge, huge savings. We are talking about 20-25% savings. If we could do that in those PPP contracts in the council, we are looking at saving £2.5+ million per annum. Now, can you imagine what an amazingly important and significant thing this is? Now, in the past, I've tried to raise this when I was an elected member. I got no support whatsoever. The previous chief executive went and asked the person that had created those PPPs if there was any reason why they could be evaluated or looked at, and he said, of course, this was my baby, not a chance, and it would be good for you to tell me if there isn't a way that we could look at this seriously again.
Mr. Fairley.
I think I'd be directed by Council in terms of what action it wants to take in terms of instructing officers to review or otherwise the PPP contract. You're absolutely right, Mr. Divink. You've raised it on a number of occasions, and I know that colleagues have gone and reviewed the contracts and looked at where the opportunities are. They've tended to come back with very marginal savings, but I suppose that's certainly a Section 95 officer in the hands of Council as to whether it would want then to, on the back of the Audit Committee minutes going to Council, take further action on to review the contracts. And I suppose it's recognised the contracts have got different elements, the construction cost and the repayment of construction of those assets, the financing of the assets, and then a lot of soft and hard facilities management services within the contract. So They're far from straightforward contracts, but again, in Council's hands as to the terms of what it might want to do.
Councillor Smale.
Yes, I too have looked into this, and it seems that in the hospitals world there have been a number of renegotiations of ambiguous phrases, but in terms of the Scottish Schools contract, I'm not aware of anyone that has been unpicked so far. That doesn't mean we shouldn't look at it. As you know, Gary, I'm very interested in the accounting treatment. Should the asset turn out to have a longer life than 30 years? And I think the current accounting treatment is a hybrid between historic cost accounting and fair value, and it might be useful to have some further discussions as to whether we could create some sort of deferred income out of that scenario. That's a relatively minor thing compared to what Mr. De Vink would like to do. But perhaps a desktop exercise, perhaps with the help of the auditors, to see whether any other Scottish Council has made progress here would tell us whether it is worth spending more time in this space.
Mr. Reid.
Thank you. Like you, I'm aware of a number of NHS bodies that have over the years sought to reopen the previously agreed PFI or PPP contracts at the time. I'm not aware of any Scottish local authorities that have done the same, but I'm certainly happy to consult with fellow auditors to identify, if we can, of any areas, and I'm sure the Section 95 officer can have a similar discussion with his counterparts across Scottish local government. Happy to take that away.
Thank you.
Sorry, Chairman, that was really most of the points that I have wanted to raise, but I hope that you as the Chair will also raise some of the points we may have failed to have seen with your experience in this area.
Thank you, Mr. De Vink. Overall, with the Ernst & Young report, I'm pleased to see it's mainly unqualified. I was interested to see the recommendation for the review of the Financial Integrated Services Department, which I read to be a suggestion that the department be bolstered to enable better, more timely or more extensive reporting of financial information to budget holders to enable them to act more quickly in year to take corrective action. I think that was my understanding of that recommendation, amongst other things, and that I think would be a good thing.
I think, Chair, I wasn't commenting on either bolstering or not bolstering. That's not within my remit. But what I was very conscious of was the, as we've talked about, the acute financial position facing the Council. I've certainly seen it over my career, the default position, particularly where there's a salami slicing approach to trying to balance a budget of its backroom, if I can use that terminology, that are first in line. Now, while there are contributions that all parts of the Council need to make to balancing the budget, it is also very important, and I state this within the report, that to support the transformation agenda, the scale of the challenge facing the authority, not just around transformation and meeting the budget, but also on top of all of that, the demographic pressures and meeting those investment requirements, that the structure of back office services generally is appropriate with those challenges in mind.
Thank you. Sorry, my wording was a bit lazy, but I think we've got the message from the financial criticality and the financial strategy. Councillor Muirhead.
Can I just come in on that particular area? Because for me, the points I was making earlier about timely financial information, it's not about necessarily bolstering ISS, because the issues can be in each of the divisions or in the departments, because it really depends on how they're holding the data. I mean, the centre can draw the data together to present it to the managers in the way that it needs to be presented, because sometimes it's paper-based systems. I'm assuming this, but sometimes it'll be paper-based systems in some areas. There'll be spreadsheets here, there'll be access databases there, and all that type of thing. And it needs work across the council to make sure that information's held. It's not just about bolster in the centre, although I take the point that you're meaning you can cut your nose off to spite your face here if you simply just, it's where these back office sort of improvements need to be made. It's not always just tightly in the centre. Yeah.
That's true. I'm perhaps expecting something different, but that's exactly right. It's back to the comments that I think this committee's made on a number of occasions, on a number of reports over the year that I've been here, talking about management managing the management information in whatever form. I mean, I was assuming it was all coming from the centre. Perhaps that's the wrong assumption. But there needs to be an emphasis with management to control what happens in their departments to ensure that budgets are met and it's not something that they're waiting for later, and I know that's something Dr. Vickers has been looking at.
I think I was reading it in terms of what's in the action plan, in terms of a review of the capability and capacity, and I think those two things go hand in hand, and that's down in the action plan, so we would be minded to bring further reports back in terms of the work that we're doing around both the capacity and the capability.
Councillor Smale.
A couple of formal points. I consider this a very significant report, and it hugely empowers those of us who want to see some structural changes within the Council. I think, as a matter of emergency, it should be taken to the full Council next Tuesday, October the 2nd. And this I can do as provost, but I wouldn't do that unless I had the willingness of the rest of this committee, so that all of our colleagues are aware of the serious position that the Council is heading for.
Following Councillor Milligan's comments earlier, I was thinking along the same lines, and I would concur with that. I assume the members will. The report certainly gives some impetus to emphasising the need for change and action to happen now, not next year or not at some point in the future. Things need to be happening now, and it doesn't do any harm to emphasise that to every elected member and member of staff as well, I think. So if you as Provost will take that forward, I'm sure the committee backs you.
There is a logistical question which Alan Turpie can help me on. Very often these matters require paper circulated at the moment of the Council, but I believe this is so complex and detailed that we ought to attempt to circulate it before. I don't know what the protocol is for that.
Mr. Turpie.
Thank you, Chair. To be honest, Provost, the decision is usually made on the day of the meeting to take it as a matter of urgency, but I appreciate your point that if this is handed to people at the start of the council meeting, then the first action will be to go into recess to allow people to read it. It is your decision as Chair as to whether a matter is taken as urgent. Now, not normally at the day of the meeting, but I can't see why that couldn't be taken in advance of that and circulated to people to let them see it in advance. Even if you say that here's a paper I'm thinking of taking as urgent at the day of the meeting, it could perhaps be sent out on that provisional basis to allow colleagues the time to read it and to be able to have an informed debate in the council chamber about it.
Fine. So if a memo goes out in my name saying I intend this to be considered as emergency business, here is the document.
Yes, I think I've sort of adopted the phrase I am minded to these days.
Thank you.
But I don't want to be over pedantic to be your memo.
Can we organise that? Thank you very much. The other formal matter which very properly Ernst & Young have drawn to our attention is the question of their additional non-audit services, which you'll find on page 159 of 288, where we should quite properly have a discussion. My personal view is that this does not affect the independence of the auditor.
Sorry, I'm just looking for the page on the enhanced one. 162.
Appendix B, Chair, page 41 of my draft report. In the second block of text, third paragraph down, I note the 68,000 of non-audit service fees in respect to forensic advice and assistance. And then below that in the table underneath, I set out the audit fee for the year and the fees in respect of the additional audit procedures as a distinct component, noting that those are under discussion with management, and a portion of the 49 relates to the additional audit work due to the unplanned investigation into the Council's Road Division.
Thank you. Do we, Councillor Smale, you were suggesting a discussion. Do you have any discussion points, or are you happy with that?
I think you would have to form a very abstruse view that the auditor was making us look worse than we actually are in order to generate consultancy fees, and I'm sure that's not the case.
Ms. Stacey.
Just noting that the external auditor's report is in draft, and I've made some comments on already, which I understand are going to be amended prior to the your report being finalised. But just in terms of page 32, there's another it's page 154 of 292. It's page 32 of the EY report. Within the internal audit section, third paragraph down at the end, it's making reference to the external quality peer review that was completed in March 2018. So at the time of the internal audit annual assurance report that was presented to this committee on the 19th of June, that was a correct statement that it was yet to be finalised, but it was actually finalised on the 22nd of June 2018 by Highland Council. Happy to share a copy of the final report with the external auditors.
Chair, thank you. I wasn't made aware of that in the drafting process or in agreeing the draft for presentation today, so I'll pick that up offline with the Chief Internal Auditor. Just in relation to the distribution of this report to Council, over the coming days I will be intending to sign the opinion on the financial statements, and then we'll update this report to recognise that I have issued an opinion, and also taking into account the minor amendments to the report. My suggestion, if that meets with Provost's expectation and you, Chair, is that I'll do those amendments and update the report and pass another copy through to the Council so that members are seeing the final version, which would probably be more proper in the context of the distribution planned.
Agreed.
Thank you very much. Mr. Devink.
Yeah, finally, would it be possible for the Chief Executive to tell us how she is going to change the wording of her statement?
I think that will come up as the next item of business, which hopefully we'll move on to. If there's anything else on the Ernst & Young report, we'll therefore commend that to the Council via the good offices of the Provost, and move on to the financial statement report. Mr. Fairley, I think.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. So this report presents the Council's draft audited financial statements for the year to Audit Committee, and also provides a brief overview of the changes that were made during the audit process, and which you've already heard through Stephen's report. Section 2 sets out the background and the regulations that we are following in terms of preparing, auditing and then submitting the accounts. And in particularly, those regulations require the accounts to come back to the Audit Committee today alongside the auditor's report, and really for council then today to authorise the council leader to sign the statement of responsibilities page within the accounts. We've heard the changes that are made in the accounts, and section 2.1 highlights there's no qualifications in the audit opinion, and also just gives a bit more detail on the adjustments that were made during the audit process. I would draw your attention to the top of page 181, the bullet point around PFI accounting entries. The text said a correction to the PFI accounting entries which resulted in a reduction increase in deferred liabilities. It should simply be a reduction in deferred liabilities of £213,000. Section 2.2 covers the management commentary and also the changes in the management commentary and the annual governance statement. Chief Executive will outline final changes that have been agreed over the course of the last 24 hours to arrive at a final statement that will go in the accounts that are signed later this evening. And Section 3 sets out, really just reinforces the messages that were in the EY report around financial management and financial sustainability. So today, Audit Committee is recommended to approve the 1780 accounts for signature, having regard to the appointed auditor's report that we've heard earlier. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Just before you do, perhaps I'll ask Dr. Vickers to cover the annual governance statement.
Thank you. As Gary said, prior to signing any documentation, I would like to propose a change. Now, this is the final paragraph on page 206 of mine, so it might be 210. 206 and page 26 of this on the annual governance statement, page 206 on my main papers, which may be 210 on the other papers, is it? What page is that?
210.
Yep, and 210 on the other papers. So the final paragraph there, I'm just proposing an amendment that takes an extract from the external audit report to replace that at the beginning, so that it would read, the Council has an effective governance structure through committee meetings and the framework of standing orders. A number of aspects of the internal control framework require improvement, and we are aware of areas where improvements are required, and steps will be taken as a matter of urgency rather than in the forthcoming year to address these matters, therefore allowing the Council to advance its corporate governance arrangements and seek continuous improvement. Where the Council has experienced financial loss, appropriate action will be taken to seek to recover any loss.
Councillor Milligan.
Yeah, I think I wholeheartedly agree with that change. As we've both been asked to sign this, we have to have and be completely satisfied with what we're saying, and satisfied that the overall systems of internal control and risk management and governance arrangements are satisfactory standard, and there's a lot still going on and a lot to be learned yet. And I think it's clear to say that we're now looking to make that amendment, and I'm glad, Grace, that you've came in with that, because it was the same concern I had for signing this, so we'd wholeheartedly support that change.
Thank you. The draft accounts, of course, we've seen before. Any further questions that have arisen or any comments? Mr. Devink.
Yeah, my hobby horse, a correction to the PFI. This is page 181 of 292. A correction to the PFI accounting entries which resulted in a reduction increase in deferred liability. What does that mean? And just a little lower, WIST, is that meant to be while? Or I'm lost what that means.
So as I articulated earlier, the correct wording there, and my apologies for that type error, it should be a reduction in deferred liabilities of £230,000. The accounting entries themselves are detailed in the Appendix E to the Summary of Audit Adjustments and the Ernst Young report is a debit to deferred liabilities and a credit to the capital adjustment account of an equivalent sum.
Whilst
sorry, indeed, it's a typo. It should be while the responses to the audit recommendations sit with officers to implement, it does send out critical messages, and you've heard those messages, I think, today loud and clear.
Do we have any other comments, or can we move to approve the accounts for signature? Councillor Muirhead?
Do you have to move that? I'm quite happy
Sorry, I meant can we move on to approving it rather than asking any questions? If there's no other questions, we'll take that as approved. With amendment. With amendment. Okay. There being no other business comments, questions? Sorry, Mr. Short.
Sorry, just to pick up the point earlier on about the staff debt, if that's okay. A colleague has responded. So our current liability in terms of staff debt is £812,000. So I'm happy that if it's helpful, we'll look to see how we keep that. Ideally, that number would come down. So happy to keep members updated on where we are with that.
Thank you very much. In which case, I'll call the meeting to a close. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.